As sometimes happens due to the schedule, our series of shiurim begin with the parsha of Noach. That means that we've all had the opportunity to plumb the mysteries of the creation in the comfort of our own homes during the last week, and we pick up together with the story of Noach. And I would like to consider some well-known questions and offer one or two insights which perhaps are not as well-known. The opening question with regards to Noach, classically, actually accesses psukim that were written before Parshas Noach. The parsha begins by describing Noach as a tzaddik. Eile told us Noach, Noach ish tzaddik, tomim haya b'darosav. And however you explain or intone the word tzaddik, at the end of the day, it's a good thing, and he's a tzaddik. On the other hand, we're told at the very end of Parshas Bereishis, for actually Noach is introduced for us in the end of Bereishis, that's before he develops his own Parsha. The final words of Parshas Bereishis are V'Noach Motza Chein Be'enei Hashem. Noach found favor in Hashem's eyes. Now, although it's positive to be a tzaddik, and it's positive to find favor in Hashem's eyes, ultimately, those two descriptions are somewhat in conflict one with the other. Because the connotation of the word tzaddik implies that he's righteous, in which case it is correct that he should be saved. On the other hand, the expression to find favor in Hashem's eyes, motzachein, that type of grace or favor, has a connotation that Noah wasn't perhaps entirely up to par, but he found favor in Hashem's eyes. When do you appeal to finding favor? When you haven't made the grade, actually? It's almost something of a contradiction. Tzaddik means he's worthy in his own right. Motzachein means he got by on favor. Chayin Ramban says in Parshas Mishpatim, derives from the word chinam, and chinam means for nothing, means there's no real reason, but there's something about him. So that then is the question that is divided between the end of Bereishis and the beginning of Noach. What is it about Noach? Why does he deserve to be saved? Is he a tzaddik, or is it because of chayin? And if both are true, how can they work together? They're seemingly contradictory. In this vein, we note again that the opening pasuk of the parsha refers to Noach as Ish Tzadik Tomim Hayabidarosav. Tzadik, he's righteous. Tomim, he's perfect. Sounds very good. Later on, in the beginning of Perek Zion, when Hashem actually tells Noach to go into the Teva, we read Perek Zion pasuk Aleph. Vayomer Hashem leNoach, bo atav v'chol beis chel ha-teva. Come you, your family, to the teva, ki oscha ra'isi tzaddik lefonai bador hazeh. Because I've seen you before me as a tzaddik in this generation. And here we note that whereas Noach's credentials, fully expressed in the beginning of the parsha, have two aspects to them, tzaddik, tomim, apparently each one is its own area, when Hashem talks to Noach, he doesn't call him that. He doesn't say, I've seen you as a tzaddik tomim. After all, why stop at tzaddik when there's more to him than that? He's a tzaddik tomim. Hashem mentions only that he is a tzaddik. And Rashi comments, it's a well-known statement of Rashi, v'lo nemar tzaddik tomim. He doesn't say tzaddik tomim. Mikan she'omrim, from here we learn a lesson. And that's part of Rashi's job in his commentary on the Torah, not just to explain the psukim, but to tell us the lessons we learn from the Torah. Mikan she'omrim miktzas shvacha shel adam befanav v'kulo shelo befanav. It's a matter of derech eretz, of good form, correct behavior. You should say a portion of a person's praise in front of them, all of it say not in front of them. Okay, it's good for the person not to hear their entire praise, even though if they know the Rashi, they may leave the meeting wondering what it is that you left unsaid. In any event, that's Rashi's comment to explain how the Torah calls Noach Tzadik Tamim, two things, and Hashem refers to him only as a Tzadik. But a different approach, which is also important to be contemplating as we go through Parshas Noach, comes from the Sefer Maaseh Hashem. The Maaseh Hashem, the great Rabbi Elezer Ashkenazi, he's one of the early Acharonim, he was a Rav in Krakow after the Ramah, and he actually traveled and was in many, many places. And his Sefer Maaseh Hashem is monumental commentary on the Torah. And he draws our attention to quite a well-known fact, that aside from Noah's personal behavior, which was beyond reproach, there was the issue of his interaction with the other people in his generation, or more correctly, the lack thereof. We don't find that Noah went out to try and persuade people or bring them under good influence. He seems to have kept somewhat to himself. So much so that in the high levels that are demanded of tzaddikim, this is considered to be a criticism of Noach. So much so that the Chazal tell us that when the Navi Yishaya refers to the Mabul as Mei Noach, Noach's water, it's not just a chronological statement. It's an incriminating statement. It's Mei Noach in the sense that Noach is held accountable for the flood. Perhaps to some degree he could have averted it had he only gone out a little bit more. Now that's easy to say, but it is said. The Maaseh Hashem explains, and this is a chidush in Parshanut, that this is what the Torah means when it refers to Noah as Tomim B'Dorosav. Tomim B'Dorosav. The word Tomim can have a number of meanings. It can mean perfect, which is how we are inclined to understand it. But Tomim also refers to someone who is at peace with a situation. He's okay with things. In a positive way, that's to a degree what the Torah means when it tells us, Tomim tiyeh em Hashem elokecha. Instead of wondering what's going to be and how do I know, Tomim means that you're in good hands and be okay with that, be at peace with that. And therefore, when the Pasuk says that Noach was Tomim b'Dorosav, that is where the Torah actually criticizes Noach for this. He was okay with his generation, and he shouldn't have been okay. He should have been sufficiently agitated and thus activated to do something about the situation. Therefore, we see that the opening pasuk, if looked at this way, actually presents a kind of conflicting verdict on Noach, or conflicting aspects of Noach. It has a positive and a negative. The positive is he was a tzaddik, which he was in terms of his personal behavior and deportment. The negative is Tomim B'Dorosav. That wasn't okay. Now, the question is, well, how much does that count for? So he's not really doing that much to right the wrongs of his generation. To what degree does that make a difference to Noach? Well, the Gemara tells us in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Nun Hei Omid Aleph, that sometimes if someone has the capability of influencing others who are acting incorrectly and neglects to do so, he can be held accountable to a degree for their wrongdoing. The famous Mishnah of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, where the Mishnah there says that one of the cows of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, it was carrying something on Shabbos, a ribbon between its horns, and that was considered unacceptable. And the Gemara clarifies that this wasn't Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's cow. I mean, he made sure that all these cows were keeping Shabbos. But it was someone in his neighborhood. And he's Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And he could have said something about it, and therefore that cow that wasn't really acting on Shabbos, or more correctly, its owner wasn't making sure that it didn't carry something on Shabbos through the public thoroughfare, that cow becomes known as the cow of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And that's the message. And that's where the Gemara goes through all of the possibilities. It's a sliding scale. It depends on one's sphere of influence. The Gemara says perhaps you could be of influence to the entire town. Well, that's the good news. But the bad news is you could be held accountable for the wrongdoings of the town. Perhaps you're only of influence in your street, and perhaps you're only of influence in your house. But wherever it is, wherever your sphere of influence is, that's your sphere of a circle of accountability. And if that's the case, then it is possible to anticipate that maybe Noach should also be held accountable to a degree for the sins of the generation of Noach. In which case, why does he get into the teva? So what will arbiter here? On the one hand, his personal behavior demands that he should be saved, but he's not really looking out for his surroundings, which sounds like he shouldn't be saved. In this conflict, we could almost say, Ad sheyavo hakosav ashlishi v'yachriya b'neihem. Until now, the third pasuk comes to tip the balance. Enter the final pasuk of Bereishis, which says, Noach matzah chen be'enah Hashem. He needed this chen. It's not enough that he was a tzaddik, because countering the fact that he was a tzaddik was the fact that he was tomim, which the Ma'aseh Hashem explains has a negative connotation. There's a case for and a case against. What swung the balance? What tipped the balance? Noach matzah chen be'enah Hashem. At the end of the day, Noach found Hashem's eyes, and the fact that he was a tzaddik won out. With this in mind, says the Ma'aseh Hashem, we can well understand why when Hashem finally tells him to go into the Teva in the beginning of Perek Zion, go you and your family to the Teva, bo atav v'chabesko l'teva, why? Ki oscha ra'isi tzaddik lefonai bedor hazeh, because I've seen you as a tzaddik. Our question was, why only say tzaddik? Why not say tzaddik tamim? Why stop halfway? But according to the Ma'aseh Hashem, that's not halfway. Tzaddik is the good news. Tamim is the bad news. Tzaddik won out, because Noach found favor in Hashem's eyes. And therefore, Hashem only mentions that he's a tzaddik, only that which worked in his favor to enter the teva. And in this regard, it's worthwhile noting that HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Noach a number of details with regards to the makeup of the teva. In Pasuk Yud Dalet of Perek Vav, Aseh lecha tevas atzei gofer, kinim taaseh es hateva. It should be kinim. And what does the word kinim mean? Rashi explains. Madorim. A ken is like a nest, or like a bird's nest, which when you translate that into other life forms, is any living quarters. Kinim tasis ateva. It should be divided into living quarters for the various species. That's the pshat of kinim. But we should know there's a very interesting comment of the Medrash on the word kinim. For the word ken, as we mentioned, has a connotation or an association with birds specifically, kan sipor. And moreover, the concept of kinim in halacha with a kuf, kinim refers to a set of birds that are brought as a korban. Often, there are situations in the Torah, they're more in Chumash Vayikra, where someone has become Tomei, in order to become Tahor, they bring two birds, Echad Le'ola, Echad Lechatas, either the turtle doves or the B'nai Torim or B'nai Yonah. Those are called Kinim. In fact, the final Masechta of Mishnayos is Maseches Kinim, and it's all of the halachas of the combinations. What if one of the birds goes missing, which could happen, that has wings. And putting all that into the Kinim of Noach, the Medrash says something that only the Medrash can say, that the Teva was something of a kapara for Noach. Just like kinim, says the Medrash. Just like a metzora, he'll only become purified through kinim, through a set of birds. So Noach didn't bring a set of birds, I mean, they're all in with him, but the Teva is kinim, that experience. And this is itself very interesting. And many Mefarshim raise the question, does Noah have to build a teva in order to be saved? What's the goal of building the teva? I mean, it took a long time. 120 years? It's a long time. So Rashi tells us that it's in order to impress upon people that the Mabul is coming, even though no one ultimately was impressed upon. But you can only try. But the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh explains that the reason why Noach has to build a teva, and that's the way that he's saved. After all, wouldn't it be possible just to carve off a place in the world where it's not raining? According to the Gemara, Eretz Yisrael did not suffer from the Mabul. Based on the Pasuk in Yechezkel, Lo Gushma Biyom Zaam, Eretz Yisrael was not rained upon on the day of wrath. The Gemara in Tzvachim, Daf Kuf Yud Gimel, says there was no Mabul in Eretz Yisrael. And according to some, the entirety of the Mabul remained outside. So it was a good place. That's where the Yonah got the leaf from, according to the Medrash, because otherwise everything else had been destroyed. So why is Noach have to spend this year of the flood in a box? He could have spent it in Ranana. It would have been quite a somewhat more pleasant experience. Except the point is that, again, harsh words to say, but this is part of Noach's tikkun. He can't just have an easy year, because from a certain point of view, he could have done something about it. And therefore, he's cooped up. It's not so pleasant for Noach. The Gemara famously tells us of Avram's interview with Shem. It's Gemara in Perek Chelek and Sanhedrin. He met Shem of the war with the four kings and the five, Malki Tzedek, and he had to ask, "No, so what was it like in the flood?" And Shem said it was absolutely awful. We didn't get a minute's rest, and it was a terrible ordeal. But that's part of the atonement for Noah. He set himself aside, so he is isolated in every respect. In fact, the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh explains that it's when the Pasuk says that it's coated with kofar, which is pitch, but there's another word in the Torah for kofar. Zephes is the word normally used, but here it's called kofar because you can't ignore the association of the word kofar with the word kapara. The teva is a kapara for Noah. And that resonates with what the Medrash says, coming back to kinim. That the Noach was the teva was like a set of korbanos for Noach, like a mitzvah. The question we may ask is, why does Noach need to be purified? And moreover, why does the Gemara say specifically like a mitzvah? How there's a number of people that become tahor through bringing a set of birds. So say he was tamei, not pleasant, but at least general or generic, he was tamei. But the Medrash says no. He's like a mitzvah. How is Noach like a mitzvah? A mitzvah classically receives that condition for speaking Lashon Hara. Did Noach speak Lashon Hara? Well, apparently the answer is no, but yes. Because if we try and consider Noach's situation, he's not rebuking or criticizing or in any way trying to influence the people in his generation. Why not? I mean, he is a tzaddik. Wouldn't he like them to be tzaddikim? The simplest answer, apparently, is that Noach, I mean, looking around, he saw them as being beyond salvage. I mean, irredeemable. And from a certain point of view, it's hard to blame him. I mean, the world was an absolute state of tohu vavohu. And Noach says, well, it's not going to make a difference. We actually find another example. Lahavdil, ben kodesh lakodesh. Another example of someone he's kind of convinced that no one's really going to listen to him. And he's criticized for being so sure. And that is none other than Moshe Rabbeinu. At the encounter with the Mare Hasneh in Parsha Shemos, at a certain point, Moshe says in Shemos Perek Dalet Pasuk Aleph, Dayan Moshe Vayamar, Vehein lo yaminu li. They won't believe me. They'll say, Hashem didn't appear to you. They were, I'm coming with your message. I'm pretty sure they won't believe me. And Moshe was criticized for that. Because the signs that are given him to prove are also a message from Moshe. The stick turns into a snake, who's the first one to speak Lashon Hara. His hand turns leprous, which is Saras again. And again, the message is, and it's for Moshe, we don't always remembering we're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu, but the message for Moshe is, you shouldn't have said that. But that's Lashon Hara, in a sense. V'hein lo yaminu li. Noach never said those words, V'hein lo yaminu li, but he as good as said them by not really doing anything. by not trying to prevail upon the people in his generation to do better. He's basically writing them off, saying without words, "Ve'en le'aminu li." That is a non-verbal form of Lashon Hara. And that's why on Noah's level, he is considered to be like a Metzora, and he needs purification, like a Metzora needs. His Teva is Kinim, like a Metzora needs Kinim. And there is a further point here, which is discussed by my uncle, Rav Kupperman. When the flood finally abates, and the waters are going down, so Noach, he wants to find out, is there a place to go? Can we leave? Is it dry? So how does he find this out? Through a protracted business. He has, first that the O-Rave, the raven, sends it out. Raven's not interested. Okay, then he sends out the Yonah, and the Yonah circles round. What's the Siman? How will he know? If the Yonah comes back, there's no room for it to nest itself, to park itself. If it doesn't come back, that means that the land has dried up. First time round, the Yonah comes back. So what does Noah do? Waits. 7 days. It's a long time. Sends it out again. Comes back with an olive branch, olive leaf. No, we're getting somewhere. Then, another 7 days, to finally the Yonah doesn't come back. That's a month. And what's Noah doing the whole time here? Waiting. So here's a poshet ha-shaila. Why do you have to rely on birds to find out whether the land is dry? Why don't you just stick your head up and look, and then you'll see? I mean, the birds may be a reliable simmer, but there's no seeing is believing. No substitute for your own two eyes. It's a simple shaila. We assume that daylight was available by this stage. So what's with the birds? It took a month. So the answer that Rav Kupperman gives is much food for thought. It's based on a pasuk in Parshas Vayera. There, when Lot and his wife and whoever is interested in coming, which is very few people, when as they're leaving the city of Sodom, they're given an instruction. Al tabit acharecha, do not look behind you. Don't look back. Why can't they look back? Rashi explains from the Medrash. Because Lot didn't really deserve to be taken out of Sodom. Lot was extracted from Sodom in the merit of Avram, as is demonstrated through the Psukim. And therefore, he's not allowed to look back. And the meaning is that looking back means that he's witnessing the destruction of that city, but he's safe from a vantage point of security. He's looking at this disaster scenario, but he doesn't deserve to see it because he should have been there. Don't look back. His wife looked back. Did not work out well. Now, that's Lot. When we come to Noah, it's somewhat more nuanced. Because it's never correct to say that Noah should have been outside of the Teva. He should have been there with them. I mean, he is a tzaddik. But there's another problem. Not that he should have been outside. But there's at least someone or some people outside who should have been inside. In other words, it comes back again to Ve'en le'aminu li, didn't try to prevail upon them. If he had, who knows? Maybe there would have been another handful of families in Noah's Ark. And therefore, the inability to witness that destruction is still about the fact that the division is not clear-cut. Certainly, we wouldn't say that Noah should have been there, like we do with Lot and Sodom, but someone from there should have been here. So you can't be inside and seeing that scene of destruction. So much so that this may well explain to us why it is that until the ground is completely dried and all traces of the marble have been removed, Noah will need to rely on birds to find out whether the ground is dried up. He's not entitled to stick his head up and look outside, because if the marble's still going on, that's unacceptable for him. And hence, it takes a while, and he needs to work it out, and it doesn't work with the raven, and he tries with the yonah, but there is no other choice until he knows for a fact that the ground is dried and the mabul is finished. Then only then is Noach licensed to look out on the world again. And I believe it's an important discussion, but doubly important to be conducted in the correct way. It's quite a popular topic. Noach could have done more. Why didn't he rebuke the people of his generation? But it's only a valid discussion if we then consider, like Rashi will always want us to, well, what's the lesson to be learned from here? Because we're all surrounded by people that perhaps could do with a bit of a good word or guidance or positive influence. So we're only entitled, I believe, to discuss Noach in this way if the takeaway from that discussion is, well, and how are we? Are we also in a teva, not looking out? In this respect, the rectification of Noach came from Moshe Rabbeinu himself. For the ultimate act of self-sacrifice on behalf of others was when Moshe Rabbeinu said at the time of the Egel, if you do not forgive the Jewish people, Mecheini no misifrecha, take me with them, I'm not prepared to be just to remain while all of them are wiped out. Mecheini no misifrecha. And as the Zohar Kodesh points out, the word Mecheini, which is the motif word there, Mem Ches Nun Yud, actually contains the letters of the two words Mei Noach. Because by Moshe saying Mecheini, he is rectifying the mistake of Mei Noach and showing that the leader needs to have the concerns always of his people as well. So these are some comments with regards to Noach. And from there, we move on to discuss the mabul. Noach makes his famous ark to escape the flood. And there's a fascinating medrash. It's the Medrash Tehillim, which is known as Medrash Shocher Tov, a separate collection of Midrashim on Sefer Tehillim. And in Perek Zion of Medrash Shocher Tov, it describes who came into the Teva? Oh, everyone. I mean, anyone who wanted to remain after that year had to come to the Teva. And the Medrash tells us that while everyone was coming, approaching Noach to enter the ark, Sheker also came. Falsehood. Doesn't want to be destroyed along with the flood. He came, he wants to enter into the ark. Okay. Well, Noach's reply to falsehood was very interesting. And that is, no one can come in without a partner. Everyone's coming in two by two. But there's only one falsehood. So you may have to think about who you'll be having as your partner if you want to come into the ark. That's an interesting challenge for falsehood. Falsehood has to think outside of the box if it wants to make it into the teva. Well, so Sheker goes to, looks around, and he finds an attribute called pachta. And pachta we could translate as selfishness. So falsehood, it's all in the Medrash, falsehood goes to selfishness and says, well, will you accompany me into the Teva? And selfishness, not surprisingly, said, well, what's in it for me? And to that, falsehood says, okay, here's our arrangement. Anything that I receive will be given over to you. And selfishness said, that sounds like a very good arrangement. And they both entered into the Teva. Ve'ein ha-medrash hazeh omer ela darsheni. This medrash is certainly enigmatic in the extreme. What are Chazal communicating to us through this description? When we consider the cause for the mabul, which again is mentioned in the end of Parshas Bereishis already, in Perek Vav, Pasuk Hey. So the Pasuk reads, Vayar Hashem, Ki Rabba Ras Ha'adam Ba'aretz. Hashem saw the evil in the world that created, perpetrated by man was great. Kol Yetzer Machshavos Libo Rak Rak Kol Hayom, and his inclinations are towards evil, and was a terrible situation. Now, after the flood, if we move forward to Perek Ches Pasuk Kaf Aleph, and let us see how HaKadosh Baruch Hu describes things after the flood. Noach leaves the Teva, he brings korbanos. And Pasuk Kaf Aleph of Perek Ches reads, Vayorach Hashem Esreach HaNechoach, Hashem smelt a pleasing odor, aroma, Vayomer Hashem Alibo, Lo Osif Lekalal Oles Ha'odah, As Ha'adama Vavur Ha'odah. Never again will I curse the world for man, meaning never again will I bring a flood. Ki Yetzer Lev Ha'odam Rami Ne'urov. For man's evil inclination, it's bad from the very beginning. I'll never smite life the way that I did in this flood. And the Abarbanel raises a question. We have what seems to be exactly the same problem mentioned in two different psukim, but the first time it precipitates the flood, and the second time it's the explanation as to why there will never be another one. Both psukim describe the evil inclination of man. And the first time at the end of Bereishis, it says Hashem saw a man was so evil and corrupt, he's got to bring a mabul. The second time Hashem says, I'm never going to bring a mabul. Why? Because man is evil and corrupt. But that's the motion for, not the motion against. So how do we understand these psukim? That's the question of the Abarbanel. And this brings us to a basic question, similar to one that we've asked earlier, namely, if we may ask, why was the world destroyed, or why were people punished in this way through a flood? And the flood lasted a long time, lasted a year. The rain came down for 40 days, and the water just kept on increasing. And it was a year till Noah came out. But in order to punish the perpetrators, that doesn't take a year. It could take a day. Even a day of flood, by the time the day is finished, that's that. And, of course, this question is discussed by many Mefarshim. But one of the classic Sifrei Hadrush, the Sefer Afike Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda Edel of Slonim, explains that the answer, or the insight into the matter, is based in Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. And let's see what it says there. Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayomer Lekim Lenoach, Keitz Kol Basar Ba Lefonai. The end of all flesh has come before me. Ki Malah Haaretz Chametz, but the world is full of violence. V'hinini Mashchisam Es Haaretz. And I will destroy them Es Haaretz. What is the meaning of those two words, Es Haaretz? Rashi gives two explanations. The first, Al Derech HaPshat, is that Es means I will destroy them Min Haaretz, from the land. And Rashi gives an example of how the word Es can mean from. Es can be a substitute for the word Min. So I will destroy them Min Haaretz. But the second explanation, Mashchisam Es Haaretz, which is a kind of a discordant sounding phrase, the word Es, says Rashi, is a word for with. Im and Es belong, are sister words, which means Hinini Mashchisam Es Haaretz, I will destroy them with the land. What does that mean? Rashi comments, Im Haaretz, Sha'af Gimel Tfachim Shel Omer Kamacharesha Nimocho V'Nitashtashu. Even the top soil, the top three Tfachim, the outer layer of the world, was also completely destroyed. So I will destroy man, says Hashem, Es Haaretz, with the world. Why does the world need to be destroyed together with man? These words are elaborated upon, or find more elaborate expression, in the Medrash Rabbah. And the Medrash states, to understand why the world, and a part of the world, a layer of the world, was also destroyed when mankind was destroyed. Mashal leben melachim, shahayalo pedagog. It can be compared to a child of royal lineage, and he had a teacher, pedagog. Okay, is it a good idea to be the teacher of royalty? Depends how royalty behaves. Kolzman shehu soreach. So whenever the child misbehaved, so who got punished? Possibly the child. But haya pedagog shelo nirda. But the teacher also got punished. That's what you're teaching him. Kach omar kodesh baruch hu hinani mashchisam es haaretz. So too, Hashem said, I will destroy them together with the world. That's an elaboration on Rashi's source from Chazal. And what that means is that the world is being portrayed here as the teacher of man. The earth is the pedagogue of man. But what could that possibly mean? Nafika Yehuda explains that man is influenced by his background, his basis, his environment. And the physical environment leading up to the Mabul was, it seems, too strong, too potent, too physical. Perhaps someone of great stature could retain balance. But for most people, they got swept along with it. And in fact, in the end of Parshas Bereishis, it describes again that pasuk, Vayar Hashem ki rabba ro'as ha'adam ba'aretz, meaning man in the physical setting. It was too physical. It was overwhelmingly so. And therefore, what's described in that pasuk, again, in Perek Vav Pasuk Hei, is a terrifying situation that mankind had allowed itself to slip into. The pasuk reads, Vayar Hashem ki rabba ro'as ha'adam ba'aretz. It was excessive. V'chol yetzer machshivos libo, every inclination of thought of his heart, rak ra kol hayom. Only evil the whole day. That's more than evil. Because when we think of evil, we may think of someone who's prepared to do the wrong thing, but he has another thought. There's an overarching thought. There's an endgame thought that if he bends the rules or whatever, at least he'll end up in a good way. But if the pasuk says, rak rak ol hayom, it sounds like there was no goal that was meant to justify the evil. It didn't need to be justified. It existed for its own sake. Rak rak ol hayom. That is too much. And in fact, we find that there was a kind of a corruption that served no purpose except to be corrupt. In the beginning of Noach, it says, "Ki yishchis in pasuk yud beis, ki yishchis kol basar hashtarko al aretz." Every living creature. The Gemara says that the people were intermating all of the species, whatever they could find. They just put it together with something else. To what end? Nothing productive will come out. There's no gain with which you can say, we'll do the wrong things for this positive outcome. There's no positive outcome. It's corruption for corruption's sake. And that's why a word that features prominently in the beginning of Noah, for example, in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vatishachez Aretz Lefnei Ha'elokim, and again, Pasuk Yud Beis, V'hinei Nishchasa, and the third time in Pasuk Yud Gimel, V'hinei Mashchisam is already the response, but V'hinei Nishchasa, we perhaps would translate as the world was corrupt, but L'shachez is to destroy. It's a type of evil that was simply acting destructively for its own sake. Which means that Hashem's response to the situation, in a sense, is twofold. Number one, at the end of the day, the people had the ability to choose correctly, and they chose incorrectly. And they need to answer for that. That's their punishment. But something else. The world needs to be toned down in order to have a working chance of succeeding in the future. The physical nature of the world needs to be modified, needs to be mollified. And therefore, this gives us an entirely new perspective on the Mabul. The Mabul was not only there to exact retribution and kill those that were acting destructively, but the Mabul was there to rinse out the world. It was there to put the world through a kind of a laundering, a cleansing, a diluting. That's the goal of the Mabul. That's why the world was destroyed along with man, and the world is called the pedagogue of man. It's man's teacher, in the sense that in the mashal, the child learns his lessons. He takes his cue from his teacher. Man took his cue from the world, in the sense that the potent nature of the physicality of the world led man to have these all terribly destructive thoughts. That's why when man is punished, the teacher needs to be punished. The source, in a sense, of this needs to be punished. And the world is pummeled. And it isn't just pummeled. It soaks for almost a year until it's diluted in that way. Until its power is lessened. We find, interestingly, that after the Mabul, people didn't live as long as they used to live. I mean, that's a metric of the potency of the physical nature of the world going down. So what would originally began 700, 800, 900 was par for the course, but it diminishes because the world doesn't sustain life in that way anymore. It's been weakened for a good cause. And so, we can understand why after the Mabul, Hashem says he'll never bring another Mabul. We may ask, well, doesn't it depend? In other words, what if the world, chas v'chalila, deserves another Mabul? Why would you not bring it? Unless you say that it won't deserve it, in which case, what's the undertaking here? But the point is, Hashem had, in a sense, reconfigured the world, that it would never be able to support the circumstances that led to the Mabul. And that's why when we go back to that pasuk, again, it's Perek Ches Pasuk Kaf Aleph, these words and phrases seem so similar to each other, that's why they need to be pondered very carefully to see how they're so different from each other. Because originally, in the end of Bereishis, it says that Yetzer Machshavos Libo, what's the inclination of man? Rak Rak Kol Hayom. Only his end goal is evil. That's unacceptable. The answer to that is a Mabul. But after the Mabul, does man still have a Yetzer Hara? Yes, and he needs a Yetzer Hara, because otherwise how can he choose good if there's no inclination to evil? But the Yetzer Hara has been modified. It's been localized. For now, the Pasuk says, in Pasuk Kafalof of Ches, Lo'osif lekalel odes ha'adam abavur ha'adam. I'll never again curse the land because of man. Why not? Because at this point it will no longer be the land's fault. The land is not the cause of the problem anymore. Man might be. Ki yetzer lev ha'adam ra min urav. Man has the yetzer hara min urav. But min urav means from his youth, means that's how he's born. He's born with it. And everyone has a yetzer hara. But that can be contained. And that's, he may now be still do the wrong thing. But it's not the overwhelming atmospheric influence of the world to move him towards evil the whole time. He may have a move towards evil. That comes from the inside, some inner goal or gain that he has. Yeah, and he has to reckon with that. And maybe he'll fail. And that's part of free will. But that's not grounds for a Mabul. And so, we could say the difference between life before the Mabul and after the Mabul is not that there was evil before the Mabul and none afterwards. That's not true, as unfortunately we know. The difference is that before the Mabul, it was evil for evil's sake that was prevalent and global, and afterwards, evil may exist, but it will be for some other goal. And it's easier to contain, and different people have different goals. They're hardly likely to unite. And so, let us consider, says the Afike Yehuda, everything that is to exist in the world after the flood can only do so in one way, if it's in the Teva during the flood, because everything outside got destroyed. Now, if evil also needs to exist outside after the flood, it also has to be in the Teva during the flood. I don't know if that part of the Teva was particularly popular, but it's got to be there. It's a critical ingredient for the meaningful function of the world. However, there's one provisor. Sheker, falsehood, meaning wrong behavior. Falsehood representing wrongful behavior. Wants to enter the teva, but Noach doesn't let it, not by itself. Because if evil enters by itself, that means that evil is allowed to continue to exist only for the sake of evil. That's got to come to an end with the Mabul. That's a new world order. There could still be evil, however, says Noach, but you need a partner. Evil will need a reason now. It can't just be because it's wrong. And evil looks around and it finds selfishness. And together they can enter the teva. Because that's the only way that the mode of evil that can exist after the flood. It's still a Yetzirah, but it's not that pure evil for the sake of evil. These are, of course, generalizations and globalizations. There are, unfortunately, individuals or groups that have proven exceptional even to this rule in the post. They're a throwback from the way the world was before the Mabul, unfortunately. But this is the message of the Medrash, which is a fascinating explanation, such an opaque description. Falsehood has no partner, finds selfishness. Ultimately, it's a discussion of the nature of evil that led to the Mabul and the type of evil that was allowed to exist post the Mabul. Well, from here, we move to a section at the end of the Parsha. Very mysterious, because the Torah doesn't really spell out a great deal. And that's the Dor HaPlaga, the generation of dispersal. And that is in the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph. I mean, the Pasuk doesn't seem really to identify what was terribly wrong. Not explicitly. This is the famous section of the Dor HaPlaga. It is parenthetically incorrectly pronounced often as the Dor HaFlaga. But HaFlaga is a term which means that the hay is part of the word. HaPlaga or HaHaFlaga are correct. But in any case, that's the least of their worries, but just in terms of the correct pronunciation. So what do we see? Just to read the psukim, "Vayhi kol ha'aretz sofa echas u'dvar machodim," the entire nation, the entire world, was one language, unified words even. This actually doesn't sound that bad. "Vayhi b'nosa mikedem v'im tzubikor be'eretz shina v'yeshvu sham." They found a valley, they settled there. And they want to build a tower. Pasuk dalet v'yemu, "Hava nivla lanu ir." Let's build a city, umigdav roshav shamayim, with a tower that reaches up to the heavens. V'nasa lanu shem, we'll make a name for ourselves. Penafutza p'nekos, we don't want to be dispersed. And again, so far, it doesn't sound like anything criminal has happened. They want to make a tower. It's true, already through the lens of the Medrash and Rashi quotes this, they want a tower with its head leading up to the heavens. That's already a statement. I mean, that's an anti-heaven statement. Okay, one can see it. But certainly the Pasuk doesn't seem to spell it out. Then, Pasuk Hey, Vayered Hashem l'ro'os es ha'ir v'samigdal Hashem, so to speak, descended to see the city and to see the tower, which is again is a very unusual expression. Hashem went down to see the city. Hashem has seen things before. Hashem has been described as seeing things before in the Torah. For example, in Parshas Noah, the beginning, end of Rashi, Vayar Hashem, Hashem saw that evil reigned in the world. It doesn't say Vayered Hashem l'ro'os es ra'as ha'adam, but here when it comes to this tower, it says Hashem went down. On the contrary, they're building up. Pasuk Vav, also, to read the words, Vayomer Hashem, Hein Am Echad, there's one nation, V'sof Ha'achas L'kulam, one language, V'zeh Achilam Lasos, and this they've begun to do, V'ata Lo Yibatzer Mehem Kol HaShe'os Melasos, nothing will be withheld from them, anything that they decide to do. But what are they deciding to do? Doesn't say. And the response was to confuse their languages, no one spoke the same language, and they dispersed. The whole parsha is very difficult And many, many Mefarshim discuss it. But an approach which is shared by the Ran in his Droshas and also by the Sforno in his commentary on the Torah is actually that so far the people of Bavel in this with this tower, they haven't done anything terribly wrong. The tower itself is not a terribly wrong thing. Moreover, should we wonder, well, what type of punishment is it that they can't understand each other? Says the Ran, it's not a punishment. Something else is going on here. It's a very delicate situation. These people, I mean, we do see that they have a tendency towards Avodah Zarah. Now, Avodah Zarah is a terrible crime, but we don't find that people are punished collectively for it. But the point is, as the Ran and Sforno explain, that essentially the entire humankind, it seems, has assembled around this center, and they're currently heading in a wrong direction, right? There's tendencies towards Avodah Zarah. The more they assemble around this tower, and the king we know is Nimrod there, the more they will be, in a sense, locked in, inexorably, towards evil. Because they're all doing the same thing, and they all speak the same language, and they all think the same thoughts, and they're all united around the same person, and everybody follows his cue. And the Sforno says a very major idea. Unity, we always look upon as the ultimate value. It's the ultimate value if you're doing the right thing, because it's great to be unified around that. We say in our tefillahs for Rosh Hashanah, V'yasuchulam aguda achas, lasus v'tonucho b'leivav sholeh, let the world finally and speedily become one group to do Hashem's will, b'leivav sholeh. That's an amazing vision. But unity itself can be abused, because if they're unified around a wrong idea, there's nothing to stop it. Because there's no dissent. No one can criticize. No one can have a contrary thought. No one can say anything. So no one will ever think again as to whether they're doing the right thing. And if they're doing the wrong thing, that's a path which is irreversible. Path of no return. That's why there's nothing wrong with building a tower. There's nothing wrong with building a city. But if the whole Ruach of the place is heading towards Avodah Zarah, then to unify that around a tower is a terrible thing. That's why you seal the exit from it. That's why Pasuk Hei says, Vayered Hashem Leros, Hashem descended. We never found that expression before. But the Sforno explains, and the Ran, that if it's just a question of seeing, and even seeing correctly something that's being done wrong, that's called Vayar. And even that's a chiddush, to say that Hashem saw. But here nothing was being terribly wrong with the tower. But vayered Hashem. Hashem descended. The idea of being yorid means to see what will come out from something. Lahavdil, again, in kodesh lakodesh, the way Chazal used the expression, yorid lesof dato, to plumb the end result of something. How will this work out? How will this play out? And therefore, Vayered Hashem. Hashem says, this tower, nothing terribly wrong with this tower, but what will be assembled around it, there'll be no return. And that's why Hashem speaks in that way. Look at what they've begun. They're one nation, one language. Doesn't sound too bad, but it is if they're one nation around a bad idea. And this is they've begun. V'ata lo yibatzer mehem. Nothing will stop them, because no one will stop them. Kol ha'sheyozmu la'asos. Any bad idea will become the lot of the masses without dissent, and they'll be set on a course of irrevocable destruction. So what's the response? Again, to phrase it correctly, the response is not to punish them because they haven't done a crime. The dispersal of the nations isn't to punish them. It's to prevent that disaster from happening. Hashem arranged that they don't speak each other's language anymore. What that means is groups now arise. They don't consider everyone to be of the same idea. They don't have the same ideas as everybody else. That's very important, because as long as people are prone to the wrong ideas, there'll always need to be someone else who has a contrary idea to them. There needs to be an opposing voice in order that the entirety of mankind isn't locked into a wrong course. And that's, in a sense, the reclaiming of the virtue of diversity. You need it if the path may be one that needs to be criticized. And what's fascinating is, and with this we'll conclude, according to the Akedas Yitzhak, Rabbi Yitzhak HaRama, one of the late Rishonim, this is actually part of the program from the beginning, from post-Mabul, because we found that before the Mabul, again, everyone seemed to be doing the wrong thing. It's very difficult to find a lone voice. Noah was the one exception. And that's why the part of the prevention of the Mabul happening again is that people were never really as similar to each other as they used to be. And that's why, says Akedas Yitzhak, the Os Bris, the sign of the covenant that there'll never be another Mabul, is the rainbow. Now, rainbow actually looks quite nice. So how is this somehow has this disastrous association? You see a rainbow. But the Akedas Yitzhak says, because what is a rainbow? It's basically, it takes what otherwise would look exactly the same, white light, and it splays it into seven different colors. That's what happens to mankind. That's what has to happen to them in order to prevent another Mabul. They need to become different colors. They need to have different attitudes now, different approaches. Because if they're all the same, they're all white light, but it goes dark, they'll all go. And that's what happened before the Mabul. And therefore, that's the atmospheric association of the rainbow of all things with the prevention of another Mabul. So these are some comments. We have never discussed the Dor HaFloga, and we are Kanai Nahara beginning our 20th year of the Shir. So I thought that something needs to be rectified. And rest assured, of course, there's plenty more to say. But amid Hashem, we look forward to a time, and we know from our own surroundings, divisiveness amongst people is not always a bad thing. Sometimes it preserves us. But when Mirtashem, we look forward to a time when people have the right ideas, and then unity will be reclaimed. Yes, we call them unto the Achas Lasus with Tzoncha, Balevav Shalom.